Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Karen Bloomquist will be speaking on countering violence in our communities. So let's listen in on Karen.
All of your hands a copy of a message on community violence that we were involved in developing during the first half of this year and that was adopted by the ELCA Church Council this spring. And so what I'd like us to do is use that as kind of a framework for getting into some discussion about some of the realities of violence as we are aware of them in the communities where we come from, as well as within the wider society, some sense of the faith out of which we respond to those realities. And then I'm hoping a good portion of our hour together can be spent focusing on number three. What are some of the measures? What are some of the ways in which we see there being some effective attempts to counter violence in our communities? I think a lot of the time we spend a lot of time bemoaning what's happening, but trying to get to some specific kinds of measures that may not solve the problem, but at least can in different ways chip away at some of the underlying causes is, I think, an important kind of thing that we need to give some attention to. Let me begin just by saying that in the ELCA, a message is intended to be a document that gives timely, urgent attention to some concern that needs to be brought before the church. It's, for the most part, based on some of the positions that the church has taken through social statements, resolutions, and the rest. And some of those are footnoted in this particular document. But they don't involve a whole process of sending out drafts that, you know, take a year or 2 years. It's not a long kind of process like a social statement, seeing some of you have been involved in some of those discussions about that process with me earlier this week. But typically what happens is there's some initial consulting with a variety of people who have some expertise in this area and some particular interests, and that certainly was true with this. Then there is drafting that our staff does and that is circulated with that group as well as church council and our board and some others with particular interests in that. And then that feedback results in the revision of this. So it's like a total of maybe a 2 to 4 month process rather than a 2 to 4 year process. But at least our experience is that there's more and more enthusiasm for how this particular vehicle has the possibility of bringing some perspectives of the church to bear on some timely and urgent issue. And I quite frankly was glad that we were actually asked to do this by the 93 Churchwide Assembly. There was an action taken requesting that this be developed. And I was we were quite friendly toward that because I think this is an issue that, particularly within this last year, there's been, I think, more and more public sentiment stirred up about the realities of violence in our communities and what are we going to do about it. So I would say that one of the ways of characterizing this, and we're going to get into it, and at least I'm going to try to identify some of the important things within the draft, is that it tries to speak to what can be a lot of paranoiac, almost knee-jerk kinds of reactions to say, oh, you know, we've got to do this and this, and if only we did that, then somehow violence would be solved. It tries to move us beyond simply latching on to simplistic solutions or kinds of appeals that we might hear in the political arena. If only we do this, if only we do that, somehow that will solve the problem. In attempts to open up the issue to get at some of the complexity of the causes, saying, yes, there are some short-term things we can do, But we're also dealing with long-term kinds of things that are going to require lots of ongoing commitment in terms of addressing the increasing incidence of violence in our society. Before I get into it, though, let me just see how many of you have read or are familiar with this from before. It was sent to all ELCA congregations this summer, so some of you may have seen it. I know, but I just thought I'd check it out.
You probably heard Dad's basket.
Okay, so therefore, assuming that most of us are not that familiar with it, let me take us through it. This begins by, first of all, noting what one might call the taken-for-grantedness of violence in our culture and in our history. I'm continually struck by comments that people from other countries will often make about how violence is almost taken for granted in terms of American culture and in media, and I think there's a very real way in which some of the most noted exports from this country are what are embodied in media and some of the stories of the West and all the other kinds of stories that are part of the impression of what our culture is about. I don't know if anyone has any comments on that, but I think that's often a pervasive kind of impression. Certainly if you come from a place like Chicago, people immediately say, oh yeah, Al Capone, and it's what it is that certain places in our country, or those of you from Texas, I suppose there's a lot of ways in which lots of stories and stuff related to Texas, or we could say the Far West, and how that's been a part of the kind of air that we've breathed in terms of our upbringing and the way in which certain sense of what it means to conquer the frontier and all the rest, how that is fed into our national consciousness. But at the same time, recognizing that as kind of a backdrop, there are some differences, there are some things that are distinctive, disturbingly distinctive, about violence in our own day. And the second paragraph of this tries to cite what some of those are, and this may evoke some other things that you're aware of that are, and I would invite you to share some of those. The random shootings, it's the randomness of violence that I think has become especially disturbing. The graphic portrayals, particularly in the media, of the savage violence. Certainly in Chicago, I know there, even though I'm one to like to watch the news, I've pretty much given up watching the 10 o'clock news at night, because I know probably some channels more than others that it will be 10 minutes of the most, graphic, bizarre crimes that have occurred in the Chicago area that day. And that becomes what's newsworthy.
That's not only Chicago, that's I think all these stations. I know down in Austin we had the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then somebody murdered.
Mm-hmm. Certainly TV shows, movies, video games. And how violence is related to the breakdown of our social fabric, the breakdown of families, of communities, the continuing incidence of hate crimes, of domestic violence, and how the headline news, as the last sentence of that paragraph suggests, reinforce the atmosphere of violence. In other words, this doesn't try to say that it's necessarily a direct causal relationship there, but somehow the kind of atmosphere that that is fed by the way in which these examples are given such prominence. Are there other things that you think of as being distinctive about the violence that's a part of our communities today that may not have been the case some years ago? Yeah,
Carol. It seems to me that in our area it has to do with the age of the person perpetrating the violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's incredibly young. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10, 12
yeah.
years old.
Yeah.
Doing savage acts of
yeah.
murder.
Yeah.
Murder.
So it was just sentenced to for killing a 3-year-old?
14-year-old.
The other thing, in our area, it becomes a racist issue. We have a great mm-hmm. influx of Hispanics,
mm-hmm.
and they're constantly victims or perpetrators, and that gets to be a real ethnic kind of racial thing, and so they're constantly there, and it doesn't help our community.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it is in Chicago, I guess maybe, you know, it's different ethnicity, but for us, it is a way to continue to separate our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it's always those damn Mexicans.
Mm-hmm. 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 As Carol and I were discussing before, even though there's been a large newspaper expose over the last year over really dealing with the stories of many of, say, the African-American inner city kids who've been killed, still, there's, you know, I think a real numbness, and sometimes if it's somebody, you know, from a very affluent suburban area, there can be much more prominence given to that story than the what are almost experienced as the run-of-the-mill killings that are going on every day in the inner city.
Well, look at what's been on our front pages for the last 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
The OJ stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of getting out of where, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure many people do, but.
Mm-hmm. The sensationalizing and making it a real media event.
There's money in it.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I had a response to is I was wondering, you know, I work with children a lot and it seems like part of the way that when they're kind of acting violent or relating to those issues, it's almost as if they're trying to acclimate themselves to it. In other words, they're trying to kind of keep their own sense of autonomy, that they're somehow not at risk. So in other words, by them kind of playing with it, it really is a way of them trying to manage their anxiety about this violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's some ways in which, you know, as children, they're very aware that it's a violent culture. They're trying to acclimate, you know, kind of given some of their developmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're exposed to a lot. I mean, they know mm-hmm. more about things than most of us from every day. Like you said, it's on the news, it's in the papers.
Yeah, and there's no way they can be, I mean, even if parents try to put some curbs on that. It's pervasive. And when we stop and think of how much our son has absorbed that, and it...
Saturday morning cartoons.
And look at the toys that they buy. Every other toy they've seen in the store has got something to do with the gun.
But what I'm suggesting is they need that. I mean, they need to be able to somehow to get... I mean, with kids, they deal with a certain amount of grandiosity that protects them from the anxiety. So they have to feel better than this. Otherwise, they deal with the fear and the vulnerability, and they can't manage that.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think that's part of what's kind of hard, because you don't want them to have the violence, but yet somehow they have to figure out a way of responding to
how to deal with it.
How to deal with it, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's something, because sometimes we can end up, like I said, kind of taking it out on our kids because we're frustrated with it. You know, so
mm-hmm.
that's only kind of one thing that I'm
mm-hmm.
concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow it has to be seen in their context, too, in terms of how they need to deal with that threat of violence rather than always the adults dealing with it.
Yeah, or assuming that how we dealt with it 30, 40 years ago is going to be adequate for them. Yeah.
In New Orleans, we've seen where the primary violence is in the inner city. And we saw this, the people who move further and further away from the inner city. Mm-hmm. The inner city tax base is going to pot. Mm-hmm. And they perpetuate themselves. Unfortunately, now it's starting to be out in the suburbs.
That's right.
You can't get it.
Well, and that's really what this third paragraph here is trying to get at, that... you know, we've assumed, well, okay, it happens in the inner city. It doesn't happen where we might live. You know, and yet now having to come to grips with the fact that the violence in certainly some of the suburban schools around Chicago is as, maybe not as great as in some of the inner city, but it's certainly not a place of shelter from that either. I think what becomes so fear-evoking in all of this is realizing that, in a sense, no place is safe. It's not just the random shootings in the ghetto, but it's the random shootings that might occur in the countryside, too. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but I know I've heard from a lot of people in some fairly rural areas how much the incidence of violence has increased. The end of this first page tries to do some citing of some of the factors in this. And I want you just to take note of it. It's the third line and following. Because what this attempts to do is to combine some of the social, economic, systemic kinds of factors, as well as saying, yes, there are individual pathologies, there is inadequate moral formation and guidance. In other words, what we might stereotype as either a liberal or a conservative response to this, any of those by themselves are inadequate. You know, it's a combination of factors. And I think that's why, in terms of trying to say how are we going to counter it, that means that our approach is going to be more diverse and can't just be stereotyped as, well, yeah, here go the, you know, the liberals, or here go the conservatives, or whatever. But it's a combination of responses that are needed. I think what's been interesting in recent years is those who might have looked much more at systemic, wider factor kinds of causes, saying, yeah, we've got to do also some serious address of what's happening to family life in this country, what's happening to the, you know, the way in which the internal controls of children are developed in this society. There's a psychiatrist in the village now, and he and I were having an interesting discussion about that this morning, about, you know, how do we develop those internal controls. It's a little bit related to the metaphor you were drawing on last night in Vespers, because instead what we as a society are having to do now, and this gets into the second page, are a lot of the tough on crime policy stances. Okay, we'll get more police, we'll get more prisons. Prisons then becomes, you know, what a community looks to as their hope. And I'm not saying that more prisons may not be needed, but it's like the lack of the internal stuff that means that all the external forms of control later on, far more costly and often far more futile in terms of whether it really does result in changes. You know, and we get into this kind of frustrating kind of cycle of, you know, well, we got more, you know, now we've got a crime bill that passed that supposedly will mean more police or more prisons and more this and more that. But that does not necessarily get at the causes of violence. And so I want, on the second page, to draw your attention, in the second paragraph there, it's about the third line down. Although police and prisons do help to protect society, they have no real effect on the causes of violence. And how do we, I mean, we need a both and kind of approach, and this certainly is this message is saying, yes, the role of police, the need for prisons, we don't overlook that, but we can't just assume somehow that's the answer to crime. That's part of the answer of how we protect ourselves from crime, but certainly not an all-sufficient kind of answer. And I think the danger, and what this tries to put some calm on the water, or calm the water a bit, is you know, the kind of frenetic, you know, we've got to get tough on crime, and the way that rhetoric can fool us into thinking that if only we do this and only do that, somehow then that will solve the problem. Somehow we need to have a broader kind of perspective on that. Anything more that some of you would want to say about the realities of Violence Day? Actually, this talks on the front title here, The Reality and Fear of Violence. Because objectively, there may or may not be higher rates of violence in some areas. There was an FBI report that came out several months ago saying in some kinds of crimes, there's actually been a decrease of violent crimes. But nevertheless, there's a very real fear, and it seems to be a mounting fear, a subjective kind of reality that's there, whether or not the crime increase, the crime rate has risen or is rising in a certain area.
This doesn't seem to differentiate violence against women or young black men. I mean, aren't there certain kind of segments of the population that are dramatically different? And was that kind of a conscious choice to not differentiate?
Well, the third paragraph in the front page does say people who are poor, who are of color, who live in inner cities are typically the most pervasively and deeply affected by violence. Although the point that's trying to make here is that what's that in and of itself is not that new a phenomena. But what is new is that now, you know, the plague of violence, we're realizing it's happening in more than just those places.
Well, I was just curious, because I think part of what has always struck me about certain statistics is there still are certain segments of the population, particularly women and young black men, mm-hmm. that dramatically, it's kind of like their world is just different, you know, in yeah. terms of what they have to be more mindful of than someone like
that's
myself.
Right.
You know,
just the fear of going out in the street.
Yeah, and that's something that...
Or the fear of being in one's home, too, in
yeah,
a violent
family. Yeah, you just have to think about it much more pervasively. Yep. And I think that is something that's easy for, you know, white males to not mm-hmm. take as serious or not pay attention. But so I was just kind of noticing that there wasn't
Yeah, one of the things in working on this that we were very, and there were some discussions of, hey, there's very different kinds of dynamics and remedies for violence. In fact, there is a sentence in the last paragraph of the front page that mentions that. And clearly, this would have been a much longer document in order to really do justice to that. I mean, and so there's some passing reference to that, the variety of that, but it's for the sake of length, we had to make a decision not to go in depth into that, and so it's the overall reality and fear of violence that is what is being evoked here. But I think you're quite accurate that, you know, these are very different realities, and to say that how we deal with domestic violence is the same as how we deal with gang violence or whatever, you know, it's naive to think that the strategies are the same. Okay, I want to move on to the second section. And to at least emphasize some of the theological understandings that are raised up there. First, and probably most obviously, God's resolve for peace is steadfast in the midst of the increasing incidents of violence. You shall not murder. The very clear violation of God's intentions for human life that is a part of what violent acts and are all about. But then in the second paragraph, under the responding out of the faith we confess section, in the second paragraph, before God, we all are in captivity to sin. And so this tries to raise up at least three ways in which we are captive to sin in relationship to violence. Certainly, we can point to the acts of violence by those who commit such acts, that as being sinful. On the other hand, we also need to take seriously the reality of those who have been sinned against through acts of violence, many of whom are sitting in our congregations and probably still dealing with that in some ways. And then still others who are overwhelmed by the fears of violence, the fear of going out at night, the fear of, well, when will I be the next victim of an attack, and how that fear itself can be immobilizing, can cause one to feel like one's living in a prison after a while. And so how do we as church take very seriously the way in which sin is manifest around here and speak a clear word of Christ's reconciling action, overcoming the division, overcoming the violence, speaking a word of faith in the midst of that? As I think one of the real dangers is that we as Christians can be as cynical as the population as a whole when we look out at the phenomena of violence and just kind of throw up our hands. And from my perspective, the real contrast is between succumbing to that fear and expressing our faith in a God that we know in Jesus Christ who overcomes that fear and who moves us beyond just a kind of passive resignation to the way things are, to some active ways in which we are involved in trying to address and counter the violence in our society today. The way in which the Holy Spirit empowers us, as it says at the bottom of page 2, to confront the violent tendencies within ourselves and within our society. In other words, I think it's important that we not just see violence as a tendency out there, but how get in touch with how there are violent tendencies within each of us. Now, obviously, how we deal with that can vary dramatically. But how can we as Christians respond to the call to address violent crime in more restorative ways, such as Jesus exemplified, rather than out of fear and out of vengeance or desire to get even? And then the final thing that comes through here is certainly a recognition that particularly in Lutheran theology, there is a strong strand of respect for the importance of law in ordering our common life together, and that certainly a big part of what is happening in our society today is that there isn't a respect for law. Now, there's some good reasons for that, particularly in communities that feel they've always been on the short end of the justice system, And we've got to take that very seriously and work for laws that are not discriminatory, both in their in the laws and as well as how they are enforced, the discriminatory enforcement of many laws. But that theological section here is not that extensive. It tries to emphasize some of the bases out of which we respond, and clearly providing a stance that we don't just fatalistically go along with it all and throw up our hands. Although the main thrust of this particular message is to say, now how can we move from that then to talk about measures to address in some and counter some of the violence in our society. Any responses to how it is that our faith calls us to respond to this? Some things that for you are important that you may not see in this particular message that you think also need to be a part of how we as Christians understand our calling in relationship to this?
Well, this may seem like a curious question, but who do you think your audience is? I mean, do you see yourself writing to people who are violent? Or do you see yourself writing to people who are trying to either respond to the violence, or do you not necessarily differentiate?
Well, the message is clearly written to members of our church, and to, in a sense, stir them to be more actively engaged in addressing this. In fact, I think it was wording similar to that was a part of the churchwide assembly resolution requesting that this be developed. And especially as we'll see in the next section, what this tries to acknowledge is that certainly some of our members are those who are the perpetrators of violence. So that, yes, they are a part of who needs to be addressed here. At the same time, I would want to be very modest in saying that this is not, you know, dealing with or trying to get that much into now. How do we, you know, address those who themselves are the perpetrators of this?
Because part of, you know, what goes on with me is I think about issues about property, about, you know, willfulness, about other things that feel like, at least to me, that somehow set up some of the conflicts. And I mean, there's an awful lot of violence just because people have guns in their house and want to protect their property.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder about some of the issues that feel to me are related in terms of security. You know, where does our security
mm-hmm.
lie, or mm-hmm. Ownership, or our destiny?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to what lengths can we try to control our destiny?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I guess those are some issues that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously mm-hmm. it goes back to expansive again, but
mm-hmm.
Those are things that feel somewhat practical to me as I listen to people,
mm-hmm.
As I work with people who have hurt other people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I hear mm-hmm. the issues that they're
mm-hmm.
wrestling with and how they went and crossed the line, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rarely related to whether they should do violence to somebody else. In other words, the violence is like a byproduct of, you know, wanting to protect their property, and so mm-hmm. they end up kind of doing violence. Now,
mm-hmm.
I guess certainly a person should say, if you feel like you're doing violence, then you've obviously crossed the line, and there's some other assumptions that you've made that you're giving too much authority to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I go.
Well, the way in which individual rights and property rights and, you know, economic competition or not having what I think I should have. I think those are all factors, and the underlying thing of where is our security, where is our trust, what is the basis of our identity, And is our identity somehow involved in somehow getting a piece of what I want is mine, which can be money, can be control over one's spouse, can be all kinds of ways that that gets played out.
Well, like I said, those are some other kind of, seems like some prior theological questions too.
Okay, let's move on to this, on page 3, the middle of the page, pursuing our commitment to counter community violence. As you can see, this is set up in 4 subsections, and I'll just say a word about each. First, as a community of worship, I think it's interesting that this particular message says, hey, how we deal with violence begins with how we see ourselves as a worshiping community. And here, this is speaking to one of the points Jack was raising. What does it mean for us, you know, to hear the word, to be nourished by the sacrament, strengthened to make peace, and to embrace, and it mentions here, 3 different groups of people. And I think it's important for us to be aware that there's likely to be all 3 kinds of people present on a Sunday morning in our worship. Those who are victims of violence, who often feel silenced, who don't always feel that the church is a safe place where they can really speak of how they have felt violated and somehow find some healing to the pain. Secondly, those who have done violence to others, as well as their families. So-and-so may be sitting in prison, but what about the family that's still there as part of that worshiping community? How are they being ministered to? And then finally, those who protect and defend society. Police, those who are part of judges or others who are part of the court system. Those who are involved in settling disputes in various ways, those who enter situations of violence, those who really are often walking into the eye of the storm. And, you know, are we within our worship life providing the kind of support to people like that as they try to live out their calling, as they try to do the work that they do, which in many ways is a work on behalf of the common good, but who might at times feel that what they're doing is not being sufficiently appreciated. What happens on Sunday morning? Do we name these various dimensions of violence? Or we might even think of how do certain texts, how are they heard by different people? Whether they're victims of abuse or perpetuators of abuse or those who are trying to somehow protect in situations that are full of, you know, all kinds of violence. Secondly, as a community of education and service. And what you have here is a list of items that are intended to be suggestive, not all inclusive, but what are some of the ways in which we as a church can be involved in ministering to those who are in captivity to violence? Providing a safe place, thinking here now certainly battered women's shelters, but other kinds of safe places, counseling opportunities. Various forms of conflict mediation. I think this is one of the hopeful channels of how do we really, in some effective ways, develop alternatives to dealing violently with our disagreements. How do we help to educate children and adults how to deal with their anger, their disagreement, the discrimination they face, and the disappointment that they face in nonviolent ways? In other words, a both-and kind of thing. Yes, there's a very real sense in which the systemic factors, the economic, the, you know, the racist, the other kinds of factors that are impacting people's lives, those need to be addressed. But short of those really being addressed in effective ways, how do we also need to help people develop the skills to deal with their anger in more nonviolent ways? Organizing activities and programs that are effective in moving youth, especially those attracted to gangs and hate groups, from disillusionment to hope. One of the members of our staff works in the area of community economic development, but has become very involved in some of the gang summit gatherings, ecumenical gatherings that have been occurring in the last year or two, with gang leaders and church leaders saying, how do we really address these issues? He himself is an African-American man who's lived in the south side of Chicago his whole life and takes very seriously now, how do we reach out? And, you know, these are the kids that aren't typically found within our church youth groups. But how can, you know, and I would say for the most part, when we hear gangs, it's like, oh, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with those kids. He's really saying, how can we begin to break some of those barriers and perhaps develop some threads of contact, some ways in which the church does not just distance those kids, and especially those kids who are susceptible to gangs, but how can there be some effective work begun? And I think there are some places, there are some congregations that at least he's aware of that have made some rather effective, begun in some effective ways to be involved in addressing the situation. How do we minister with persons who have committed violent crimes? How do we build relationships of trust between neighborhood residents and law enforcement officials, particularly in many minority communities where the suspicion and the distrust, much of it for some rather, there's some real reasons why that suspicion is there. How can relationships of trust be reestablished? And how can people reclaim their violence-plagued communities through, for example, community economic development, not just leaving the places there so that they become drug houses or become abandoned property, but, you know, how do we reclaim our communities and not just say, oh, well, that part of the city has gone over to the gangs, and we just kind of throw up our hands and say, not much we can do about that. I think I'll just go on and emphasize some of the other things in these lists, and then we can talk about all of them. As a community of advocacy, and here some items are suggested that are already, many of them are already items that are already a part of the public policy work that is being done through our state offices and nationally. One of the things we struggled with in developing this is that the ELCA had already, in its churchwide assembly last summer, passed a rather strong resolution in favor of gun control. And to go back to the discussion some of us were having the other day, probably not a position that some of our members feel too comfortable with. The resolution, by the way, is printed in a footnote in the back of this. And also, obviously, as a church body, through social statement, we've taken a position in opposition to the death penalty. So here, reference is made to those two particular stances that our church body has adopted. But we tried to deal with that in a way saying, well, gun control itself is not the be-all and end-all answer to violence. It can be an important kind of thing, an important kind of measure. But this doesn't try to say, oh, if only we have gun control, that will somehow solve the problem. Because as I said in the beginning, the attempt of this is to say the church's message needs to go beyond simply simplistic solutions that might appeal, that might stir people up, but may or may not be that effective. So on the one hand, yes, gun control is important, but it's, let's not put more weight on that as a measure to especially counter the causal factors. So it goes on and tries to, in the next paragraph, for example, say now we've got to get serious in addressing some of the social as well as psychological causes. You know, the moral formation that needs to occur in families, and that often is not occurring there. Short-term measures as well as long-term measures to counter the inequalities and the brokenness, the lack of internal controls and internal moral formation and all the rest. So this tries to say a lot in that paragraph, and but basically saying we've got to continually work to say now how do we have we need a variety of ways to effectively limit violence and not simply repay violence with more violence. So on the bottom of page 4. Joining with other religious communities, and the list here is actually reflective, as you can tell from the footnote, of an ecumenical letter on violence that the National Council of Churches developed, and the heads of a number of denominations signed this. It was a letter presented to President Clinton the end of last year. And therefore, it was a kind of call for how can the ecumenical community, how can churches together work together in our communities for some measures. And so it talks about replacing fear and violence with hope and reconciliation, stemming the proliferation of guns, countering the culture of violence, the kind of thing we were talking about at the very beginning, building anti-violence coalitions, developing peer mediation skills in the schools. I was glad to hear last week that now that's a requirement in all of the public schools here in the state of Washington, that there be training in peer mediation in terms of solving disputes in the schools. Because I think that if it doesn't happen at that point, early on, probably even before they get to school, it's an increasingly uphill battle that we're trying to fight. And then some of the ways of dealing with violence in terms of youth. This does, I think, give a lot of attention to violence, especially as a problem that needs to be addressed among those who are young, and therefore is an attempt to address the fact that one of the things that's distinctive and so disturbing today is how it's younger and younger people that are committing acts of violence. And then the whole matter of violence in the media, and this also refers to a whole resolution that the National Council of Churches has passed on that. On the one hand, saying there needs to be free expression in the media. In other words, not saying we just need to, that censorship is the answer, but how do we find the right balance between free expression and, on the other hand, appropriate ways to limit expressions of violence in the media and in film? And that document that's referred to has a number of measures that are referred to. And then finally, in this last section, a community of ongoing deliberation. What are some of the questions we need to be talking about? And I would want to especially emphasize this as a kind of agenda for conversation in our congregations. We need to keep talking about the appropriateness and the effectiveness of measures such as the death penalty and gun control. What this is trying to say is, okay, even if we as a church body have, through a churchwide assembly, taken an action on that, that's not the end of the conversation. We need dissenting voices who say, hey, I don't agree with that measure on gun control that's been taken, or I'm not sure that we should oppose the death penalty in all circumstances. So this is kind of saying, no, the conversation needs to continue. We need to, you know, it's conceivable that those positions a church has taken could be subject to revision in the future. So it's an attempt to say, just because you don't agree with that doesn't mean you should shut down. We need that continuing discussion. We need to question a one-sided approach to violence, to say, oh, well, if we only punish them, if we only lock them up, that'll solve the problem. Well, it may help in some situations, but then, yeah, what happens when they... Yeah, that's right. We need to object to the manipulation of the fear of violence, particularly in heated political rhetoric. Lots of ways that fear gets manipulated. Deplore how toughness on crime can play into racism. We've got to be tough on crime means we've got to get those Hispanics in Yakima or wherever. And it may not be very kosher to, you know, we aren't that upfront in our racism, but code words like tough on crime can become equivalent to some racist kinds of intents there. Need to talk about how violence has shaped and influenced our history, challenge some of the logic that we take for granted of, you know, we've got to win by destroying our opponents, and we get a sense of our own identity and worth by somehow beating out somebody else. And depictions of violence in the media, how does that affect actual violence in society? There's mixed readings on that, you know, as to whether there is a direct causal effect or not. I think there's at least, it affects the atmosphere of violence in our society. So those are some of the kinds of discussions that, ongoing discussions that this message is calling for. Not presuming that this has all the answers, but at least trying to get some of that going. So, reactions. Comments.
One of the things I think that is interesting is our presence as a church in some of those areas. I'm not sure what's happening in Chicago, which you mentioned there's something going on, but there's nothing in Yakima. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's happening in some of our other communities, but the Lutheran Church is not present as a body dealing with a lot of those issues. We have, we don't have any Hispanic Lutherans. I mean, you know, so it's just that real white kind of attitude, I think, that just continues to not facilitate, but continues to perpetuate some of the division kinds of stuff. We're not part. We're part of the problem. We don't create those bridges, those relationships to engage those other folks into the solution.
Right. That's a real tough problem. Yeah, the person I was, my staff colleague I was referring to, Gaylor Thomas, I would say that's the heart of what he's trying to do. And you know, he himself has good rapport with African-American street people, for example, in Chicago, and therefore is one, I think, an important kind of bridge person in a way that many of us would not be because of our skin, our background, etc. And he has been very effective in raising up and encouraging a number of models that are taking root now in different places around the country with some ELCA leadership. Thinking of a program in Ohio by an African-American pastor who's been very effective in dealing with countering the violent tendencies among black youth in his community, and a whole program of, you know, it involves mentoring, and it has all kind. Harvard Stevens is the name of the pastor, and he's been doing some very effective work there. I know in South Central LA, ELCA churches, Hispanic and African American, being really at the forefront of dealing with the violence that broke out. When was that? 2 years ago now. And I think it's interesting because there was an ecumenical team that went there to visit, and they said the Lutherans were probably the most effective and organized in addressing some of that early on. Now that doesn't, you know, that probably didn't, we didn't probably make as much of that as we needed to. And especially immediately saying, now how can we address it in a causal way of dealing with the need for community economic development? I think some historic black churches were very effective too, and had a lot of power and influence in that community. So I think there are some there, but it's in many ways building upon the indigenous leadership that's there already. In other words, it's not likely to happen with somebody coming in from the outside whose skin, whose culture is different. I think there are some, but I think what you're saying is so true, that it's easy for us to stand off and deplore it rather than getting our fingers dirty and to say, now where do we, you know, how do we put our money where our mouth is in terms of supporting those efforts that are trying to make a difference in those communities?
Raleigh Martinson is, I heard him at a festival. He's talking about a shift in the paradigm of how we at the local congregation level engage in the community, mm-hmm. and talking about viewing ourselves, for example, where there are, there are a variety of different levels where there needs to be the church plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, surrogate parenting for children who are without much parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole host of things which it seemed to me to be oriented toward helping us to shift our view of what mission is about.
Mm.
As opposed to going out and solve, you know, let's fix this violence.
Mm-hmm.
This was more, let's get in relationship with people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's why in this section, you know, just in terms of the worshiping community, and obviously those who aren't a part of the worshiping community too, how do we get beyond the us versus them kind of mentality that says, well, there are some violent people and then there's the rest of us who aren't violent.